Your book begins with your arrest. That day when that happened, what's the most vivid memory that you have?
When the intelligence agent handed me a slip of paper through the door, and I thought he was the mailman because he told me he had a letter. And I read the slip of paper, and all I could really make out were the words, Evin Prison. It was written in Farsi, of course. I knew Evin Prison is the most notorious prison of Iran, where many political prisoners are held. So I asked him, can I just have a moment to read this? And I tried to shut the door, but I couldn't because his foot was propping it open. And he had this indecipherable smile on his face that I can never forget. And he pushed the door open. He came in, and three other men followed him. And I could tell they were all intelligence agents.
And you're just standing there in your pajamas?
Standing there in my pajamas. I'd just thrown on this rupush, which is like this long jacket, which you're supposed to wear in front of men who are not closely related to you. And I had thrown on a headscarf. My hair was still hanging out, kind of out the back, because I'd just woken up. And they kept saying, if you cooperate, you'll be fine. We're going to take you somewhere else to question you. If you cooperate, we'll bring you back this evening. If not, you'll go to Evin Prison. First, they took me and interrogated me in an unmarked building somewhere else in Tehran. They asked me several hours of questions and asked me ridiculous things. They wanted me to confess, they said, that the book I was writing about Iran was a cover for espionage for the United States. And they kept saying, why are you interviewing so many people? Who told you to interview these people? Who's paying you to interview these people? And I kept saying, I'm just writing this book for myself. I'm not getting money from anybody. It's out of my own pocket. And they knew that I was planning to publish it overseas, or they couldn't censor it, which they didn't like very much. So at the end of this interrogation, sometime in the evening, they said, you haven't been cooperating, so you have to go to Evin Prison. And that's when we drove up north, and we passed the turnoff for my apartment and went straight to Evin Prison. And Evin is a terrifying word for all Iranians. Political prisoners are held there. There was a mass execution in 1988. Zahra Kazemi, the Iranian-Canadian journalist who was detained there in 2003, died there mysteriously a few days later, and no one has ever held accountable for her death. I had heard many stories about torture. For me, one of the most terrifying things was that nobody knew where I was. I was cut off from the world.
You write about some of the terrifying things that happened and then also some of the ridiculous things that happened. Your interrogators were insisting that you were working for the CIA because you had written for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
Actually, yeah, it was a friend of mine who worked for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. He was a photographer there, and he had emailed me recently talking about his newspaper. My interrogator said, you know, your friend works for the CIA, that friend who works for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. He's just a journalist. And they said, that paper is an arm of the CIA because it has the word intelligence in its name.
How do you react to that?
You can't reason with people who speak like that. I don't know if they really thought that, but I thought, I'm in the hands of very paranoid, close-minded people, crazy people, and it makes you very scared because you know your life is in their hands and they control you. And no matter what you say, they're going to say you're lying. You're lying.
They were trying to get you to confess, but they were also trying to get names of specific people who had asked you to spy. And they were saying that they were going to have you spy once you got out of prison. They were promising that you'd get out on the condition that you'd spy for the Iranian government. So you decided, I guess decided is the wrong word, but you confessed and you had to make up all these lies.
I knew that in the past, people had been forced to make false confessions. They had been released and then they had recanted their confessions. I thought, I'm cut off from the world. These people can do what they want with me. Nobody will ever find out. They've barred me from getting a lawyer. I'm in solitary confinement. I'm in the worst prison in Iran. These people were threatening me. They said that espionage can result in the death penalty. And they also said, we have agents all over the world. We can even find your family. And when you're in that situation, every threat is very real. So they gave a bunch of names. Americans I knew in different capacities, journalists, friends, acquaintances, people I'd interviewed in the past. They said, one of these people you have to name as the one who told you to use your book as a cover to spy for America. So I picked an innocent person, a completely innocent person, and I thought this person at least is far away from here, will not be coming here anytime soon. I'll get out and I'll tell this person what I've done, and hopefully he'll understand that I had to do this to survive.
They made you do things like you had to come up with a police composite of who you call him Mr. D, right? The person who you were forced to say was the one who asked you to spy.
Yeah, they took me to an interrogation room and they said, take off your blindfold. And there was a guy sitting there with a laptop and all these different features of the person's face, like different noses, different eyebrows, different eyes, lips, chin, hair. They said, we want you to make a composite drawing of Mr. D. In the end, it didn't really look like the Mr. D I knew, which I was very thankful for, but I had to play along anyway.
So you were just like randomly picking noses and eyebrows. I think they didn't have the right eyebrows.
Right. They had very bushy eyebrows, like Middle Eastern eyebrows.
Right. You're like, no, this guy's an American.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, I had to pretend that I was trying.
Yeah. They kept bringing up your work for Fox News. Did they cite other news organizations?
No. And the reports they brought up were from way back in 2003. And they claimed that these reports helped the CIA because they said Fox News is an arm of the Pentagon. And my reports had provided analysis of what was going on in Iran. And they wanted me to write down on this piece of paper that my reports for Fox News helped the CIA. It is very arbitrary in Iran. Yes, there are certain red lines. You shouldn't insult the supreme leader. You shouldn't insult Islam. You should try to have balance in your reports. But the laws in Iran generally are very vague, and they give judges a lot of power. They give the Iranian authorities a lot of power to interpret them as they like.
Did you feel like, because you were freelancing for several news organizations and you were writing your book, when you were arrested, was there a feeling of like, I don't have, you know, one institution behind me trying to get me out?
And, you know, most of their questions were dealing with the book I was writing and not so much about my reporting. And because the book was the focus of their interrogation, and I didn't even have a publisher yet, I knew that I was alone on that one. Once the world found out where I was, a number of news organizations that I'd worked for as a freelancer had written a letter of support to the Iranian authorities. So in a way, it was a good thing to be a freelancer because I had all sorts of news organizations that I was affiliated with. Even I had reported for like New Zealand Radio and Channel News Asia in Singapore, South Africa Broadcasting, stations in Europe. And all of these could put pressure on their governments to put pressure on the Iranian authorities. So it wasn't just the American government, but it was kind of this multilateral approach, which helps with Iran.
So you gave your false confession, and then we see in Iran a lot that people give these confessions, and then once they get out of prison, they recant them. But you recanted your confession when you were still in prison.
It was a very difficult decision to make because I thought, if I recant while I'm still here, I'm really going to make my captors furious, and then they're not going to release me as they promised. And I later found out that I had recanted 2 days after the Iranian authorities announced that they were going to free me within days. And instead, they sent me to trial and gave me 8 years in prison. But I had been so ashamed of what I had done by making that false confession that I thought, even when I get out of here, I'm not going to forgive myself.
And after that, it seemed like you sort of, there was this newfound courage.
Yeah, I felt much more defiant because I had proved to myself that I could be strong even in the most difficult moments.
There's always this calculus when journalists get captured or imprisoned where news organizations are trying to figure out, is it better to publicize it or should we keep it a secret? And is there any way to know if all of the media attention helped your case, if it had nothing to do with you being released?
I believe that it had a big impact on pressuring the Iranian authorities to release me. And I could tell that it was aggravating my captors. And I think that there are some people in that regime who more or less do care about the image of the regime. And we see that they try to present a certain image in their satellite TV programs that are aired in other countries, like Press TV, their English language program, or Al Alam, their Arabic language program. they try to control foreign journalists from certain kind of reports in Iran. They try to control images that citizen journalists are trying to send out of the country that don't show them in a very good light. So they do overall care about their image. And we've seen several cases in which when there has been more media attention on a detainee's, a prisoner's case, that prisoner either gets better treatment or is freed sooner. Mazyar Bahari, who's the Iranian-Canadian Newsweek journalist who was detained in Iran after last year's disputed presidential election there, he was able to get out after 118 days, I believe. There are other journalists, Iranian journalists, who don't have that kind of media campaign behind them or media attention. They're not dual nationals. And they've been sentenced like 5 years in prison, 6 years in prison. So in Iran's case, I think it can make a huge difference.
Did you ever hear the story that I did about you?
Which one is it?
It was while you were in prison. And I remember your dad gave an interview to NPR. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Brooke Gladstone and I, she's one of the hosts of our show, we were thinking of going to Iran, you know, sort of at the same time a lot of people were, I think, before the elections. And so I did this story, and the point was that your arrest, if one of the intended effects was to have a chilling effect at all, in my one case, it worked, because I remember my dad calling me and being like, please don't go.
I did hear that report, actually, after I was released. I'm sorry if I prevented you from going to Iran. That is, I think, one of the goals that they had, was to intimidate other journalists, other dual nationals, other people who could work independently.
There is a specific sensitivity, I think, to dual nationals, Western journalists who also have Iranian citizenship.
There is more of a sensitivity toward us because we can speak the language. We don't need a translator who's probably going to be pressured to inform on us. We don't need a government minder to travel with us. We don't have to stick to, you know, two or three big cities in Iran. We can go to the rural areas with our Iranian passports. We can come and go from the country. We're independent. I think they don't like that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's reporters, journalists who are able to do that, who can really tell inside stories and get to know the culture.
While I was reading your book, there was such a level of detail, things that you remembered from specific meals to specific conversations to the way someone dressed, even while you were in prison. Do you feel like your brain on some level was still kind of functioning as a journalist?
When you're in prison, you don't have a whole lot to distract yourself with, especially in solitary confinement. A minute feels like an hour feels like a day. And a day feels like an eternity. So you spend a lot of time just thinking and reviewing conversations in your head, like, what was it that my interrogator told me? And how did I answer? And it wasn't my intention when I was sitting in solitary confinement to think, okay, I got to remember all this so that I can write a book about it someday. But when I came out, I did have an intention to write about all this. And I took notes for several days right after I was released. And I just let them all pour out of my head before I would forget anything. And I have to say, of course, memory has its shortcomings, and my memory is not perfect. I did have to reconstruct conversations. Obviously, they're not all verbatim, but I did my best.
Your interrogators warned you all along not to ever talk about any of what happened to you. Are you ever nervous now about publicly talking about all of this stuff?
I know there is a risk, and they had warned me that they could find me anywhere in the world and make it look like I died in a car accident if I talk about these arrangements that they called. But I think that I have a responsibility and also an opportunity to share some of these stories, not my own story only, but also the stories of my cellmates, and to say that's what has happened to me is happening to so many other innocent people in prison today. So I think it's worth that risk. At the same time, maybe I'm not a priority at all for the Iranian authorities. They've got a lot of other things to focus on right now. So maybe they don't care at all. Who knows?
People probably ask you a lot why this all happened, why you were arrested. And I just wondered if you have any idea if it was just one person's desire to arrest you and, you know, give you a hard time before you leave the country. It just seems like so much wasted time and effort.
Over time, when I was incarcerated, I came to various possible conclusions. One main one was that I believe they wanted to get a false confession out of me, that they could use to further their own purposes, to intimidate Iranians trying to reach out to the West, especially America, to intimidate other journalists, dual nationals, to have some fuel for their argument that the U.S. has agents all over Iran in the guise of very ordinary people like journalists or activists or academics or humanitarian workers or people who have ties with the West. And therefore, the government must be vigilant and in the name of national security must crack down on these people. But in the long run, every time you throw somebody in prison or violate somebody's basic rights, you're not just creating resentment on the part of one person, but that person has a family, and that person has many friends. So you're breeding resentment across a growing part of Iranian society. And I saw that my cellmates, their families, other prisoners' families, sometimes they would talk while they're waiting for meetings, and they're all angry.
Do you think that you're going to keep reporting?
Possibly. I'm not sure yet what I'm going to do in the long run.
And what about going back to Iran? Do you think about that?
I do. I don't think my parents are quite ready for me to go back. And I know that now is not a good time for me to go back.